land, sea, and coastal communities.
One of the other things that I think emerges too is the way in which this region demonstrates that sort of a longevity, almost a long durée of settler capitalism.
A roundtable discussion about the environmental history of Atlantic Canada. I'm Sean Courage, and you're listening to episode 40 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. In many ways, Canada is a country of regions, and from a biogeographic perspective, it can be useful to take a regional approach to exploring its environmental history. In 2004, for example, BC Studies published a special issue on the environment of Canada's Pacific region. And earlier this year, Acadiensis Press published Land and Sea, Environmental History in Atlantic Canada, an anthology of essays edited by Claire Campbell and Robert Summerby Murray that explores numerous aspects of the environmental histories of New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, parts of Quebec, and Newfoundland and Labrador. The history of Canada's Atlantic coastal region offers a number of important insights into environmental history that are both representative of the greater nation-state of Canada and unique to the particular biogeographic conditions of the region. In some ways, Atlantic Canada shares much in common with the rest of the country as a British settler colony formerly colonized by the French and originally inhabited by a long-standing population of indigenous North Americans. From the 16th century to the early 21st century, Atlantic Canada experienced significant ecological transformations as different human communities inhabited the region and exploited its resources over the centuries. This is the broad subject of land and sea, and to learn more, I spoke with the editors and one of the authors from this new anthology.
So I'm Robert Summerby Murray at Dalhousie University.
I'm Claire Campbell, currently on leave from Dalhousie University.
I'm Bill Parento. I'm a professor at University of New Brunswick.
Well, thanks for joining us, everyone. We're here to talk a little bit about the environmental history of Atlantic Canada, and specifically a new anthology that all of you participated in called Land and Sea, Environmental History in Atlantic Canada. And I just want to begin by asking Claire and Robert to give us a little bit of insight into the origins of this project, since you were the editors for the anthology.
Well, casting my mind back through the mists of time, is one thing that, you know, really anthologies are always a bit of a surprise with, and how long they can take, because how many participants, how many stages of editing. This like most started several years ago in about 2009. We had had two what we were calling Ganong sessions, Ganong lectures and afternoon seminars, where for two consecutive years people from around the Maritimes had made their way to Dalhousie, and we had had featured speakers. We had had one point we did a field trip to Point Pleasant Park. We had a series of planning discussions about what kinds of things we could do, because one of the things about doing environmental history in Atlantic Canada is that there are a lot of us, and yet we are sort of oddly scattered and disconnected. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to do a series of, we were brainstorming projects that would allow us to work together. And I actually hope that some of the other projects come to fruition, such as some team teaching courses. But the idea of an edited collection was one of the suggestions that came out of, I think, even the first Ganong session in 2008. And then by 2009, Rob, I think, was designated definitely the editor, and I thought, you know, somebody like John Sanlos or Aaron Keeling would be the logical choice as a partner, and here we are 4 years later. So, Rob, maybe you want to pick up on that.
I'm not sure what that says about me as a potential editor. But absolutely, Claire, I mean, this comes out of a set of possibilities with the historians of the environment in the Atlantic region. And so that gathering together in all sorts of ways, looking at options for getting these stories out and finding a way to put these together in some coherent form really has a long genesis. And I think as well in those discussions, we felt that there was a long history of scholarship in our region focusing in on environments, environmental histories, both singular and plural, and everything from different forms of resources extraction all the way through to contemporary issues around environmental resource management. And so the idea of a collection was to gather some of these possibilities together, essentially to showcase in many ways the thematic pieces that we could draw together from this, as Claire's put it, rather disparate group of people initially. And I think that's one of the strengths that we saw here in terms of organizing the project. It was really, here's a great outcome if we can put it together.
Right, and the region itself has this fantastic emerging network of scholars in environmental studies and environmental history that I think we've been seeing over the past several years from the first Ganong lecture up to the publication of this anthology. Can you tell us a bit about the organizing framework for the anthology? How did you go about arranging the essays? What was your guiding principles?
There were a lot of hours in front of a whiteboard, Sean.
Yes. and some innovative photographing of whiteboard with blackberries to send to each other.
Exactly. It was a nice mix of low-tech and high-tech, I think, that we were working on. It was one of those things where we didn't have the organizing framework in mind when we issued the call. And I think that, again, that's a useful lesson because as Rob said, there's a wonderful history of environmental history in the region, but we didn't want that to determine the course of the anthology.
Right.
In many ways, one of the really interesting things about the historiography of Atlantic Canada is the clear generations, the clear evolution of the scholarship between the sort of, you know, major geographical thinkers in the mid part of the 20th century and the kind of work that's being done now. And so the call itself was very open, and we played around, I think, with a number of frameworks. We were overwhelmed by the number of submissions, it should be said, and it was really difficult to winnow down what we could fit. I mean, I think, Rob, we had, you know, well into the 30s in terms of submissions, and as it is, the anthology itself was quite big, and so we didn't have a framework. We wanted it to be chronological, or we wanted it to be, you know, there were a certain number of themes we needed to cover. We really wanted to see what people would return to us with, and the clusters that emerge, sort of knowledge of the natural world, experiments in conservation and types of management, and then community response and adaptation, they sort of clustered quite organically, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And inside those, we were looking for some elements of chronological coherence, mm-hmm. but we're also looking at ways in which those thematic clusters could demonstrate the different ways in which we have approached environment over time. Mm-hmm. So the idea of actually constructing the natural world, what forms does that process take in terms of resource elements, responding to particular positions and even ideologies around nature and landscape, and then all the way through to the ways in which we manage quite explicitly. And I think Bill's work is a great example of the ways in which we wanted to see the management structures that around environment that have evolved in terms of historical change. And then also thinking about this issue of community and sustainability. And that got us into some areas that I think are really very, very topical for many of us in terms of connecting to natural hazard research, connecting to community response to climate change, severe storm event, things like that. And that sweep chronologically and topically really allows us to go right from European attitudes to nature and the politics of those all the way through to the topicality of small communities, large communities responding to changing climates.
I will say one of the things that I struggled with, and I suspect, you know, editors of anthologies generally do, but particularly when you're dealing with a region that on the face of it, you look at a globe of the world, it's a very small part of the planet Earth. And yet, when you consider the centuries of history and you consider the diversity of ecologies, there was no way for us, we couldn't ensure that it would be fully representative, right? I mean, we couldn't, we didn't want an anthology where we were allocating on the basis of sort of, you know, proportional representation more than good scholarship. And so it's eclectic like any collection because it comes together, as Rob said, thematically more than arguably thematically more than geographically.
Right. But that also means that as we looked at the selection of essays, we were also trying to ensure that the specifics of the essay are also connected to this broader theme. So in some cases, the essays themselves are really very, very detailed. I mean, we're looking at, let's take Jonathan Ludi's example, you know, resource depletion in the Bay Bulls fishery, 1855 to 1863. Mm-hmm. Well, the challenge in there for the author and for us as editors is to be able to contextualize that, you know, wonderful piece of work in the broader discussion of conservation, environmental management, natural resource processing, so that it's no longer simply a case study, but in fact it allows us to inform many of the other processes that are at work inside a broader environmental history of the region.
Just to follow up on this question of structure of the book, did you find challenges in terms of keeping a kind of chronology? I mean, environmental history in Canada and in the United States is often weighted more to the modern period than pre-Confederation or an early modern period. Did you find that you encountered fewer submissions that dealt with an earlier period in Atlantic Canadian history?
I think that's fair. I think we were lucky in that there was some really excellent work done on the 19th mm-hmm. century, the mid mm-hmm. and late 19th century. But considering, again, the sort of centuries of encounter and adaptation and exploitation, I think it's fair to say that most of the scholarship is post-Confederation, with comparatively little in the colonial period.
Yes, although we certainly were able to pick up some key discussions in terms of some 17th and 18th century work mm-hmm. as well. And I think these are nice bookends in terms of then connecting into perhaps the most contemporary of them relates back to deindustrialization, deindustrialized landscapes and environmental histories, and indeed using the eastern white cedar as a proxy for climate change. So that really has a broad sweep inside that. And I think that is probably one of the strengths of the collection, as it turned out, even though it was challenging for us as we tried to find the particular frame to put all those things in. And as you look at the contents page of the book that I have in front of me, I'm looking at this and then looking at the other notes that I have in the file in front of me, and we had all sorts of permutations in front of us as we tried to find the best way of connecting across a long time period. And as Claire has suggested, there are a number of gaps. I mean, I think one of the challenges we see is working, for example, First Nations understanding of environmental change mm-hmm. Into this, both from a historical and a contemporary scene. And a challenge with a collection like this is always that balance between getting that breadth of coverage, but also realizing that you have space limits in a book, in a collection of this.
Well, let's broaden out the conversation then and bring Bill into this to sort of ask the group what is it about Atlantic Canada as a region that makes it distinct in terms of its environmental history from other parts of the country? Or, I mean, you could ask the opposite question, or in what ways is Atlantic Canada really representative of Canada's environmental history?
I would say it's distinct for the length of its history of settler Aboriginal interaction. Mm. The difficult thing is that that's probably the early environmental history of the region during settler European interaction is probably the weakest part of our historiography at the present, and certainly something that needs a lot of work. I've started to do some projects with my undergraduate honors classes on regulation of rivers, for example, and waterways. But I would say that's that. And I think the other thing is that the region is more integrated than other parts of Canada, modern Canada, into the Atlantic World Colonial Project in for centuries. the patterns and timing of settlement, resource policy and resource exploitation. All four colonies were driven to a great extent by colonial economic initiatives and objectives. So I think that that's something that makes the region distinct.
I'd say, I'd being the kind of quintessential Mackenzie King Canadian, I'd say on the one hand, and on the other hand, as we've talked about the organization of the book, the diversity is really prominent. And when I think about, sort of images of prairie economic environmental history, the Atlantic region has a canon of iconic moments. But I didn't in the submissions, and I still don't see a defining period and a sort of a singular image that the region has carried through the 20th and 21st centuries. It can morph very easily from 17th, 16th century contact to 19th century coal reserves to 20th century fishery collapse. And that would lead me into my, on the other hand, where it's representative of environmental history and environmental trajectory, is that, as we know, there are, maritimers in northern Alberta, right, mm-hmm. employed in the oil sands.
Mm-hmm.
And the region of Atlantic Canada has been basically trying to tell the rest of Canada and North America that harvest-based resource extractive industries are ultimately not sustainable, and they're not socially sustainable, they're not environmentally sustainable, they're not even economically sustainable. And in that sense, we're I don't want to say canary in the coal mine because it's such a bad pun in this context, but in that sense, we're out a little bit ahead from the other regions in terms of resource exhaustion and needing to move into, again, another generation of economic growth. And I think in that sense, that's what makes studying this region so valuable. We're ahead of the curve.
I would agree with Claire. I would also say that the hope is that we learn the lessons, and some days pessimistic that we've actually mm-hmm. learned those lessons ourselves here in Atlantic Canada. And I'll speak to that a little bit more later, but that's the only sort of caveat I would put to that. I generally agree with it.
And I think those are excellent comments. One of the other things that I think emerges too is the way in which this region demonstrates that sort of a longevity, almost a long durée of settler capitalism. And we could, we could have used organizing frameworks like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this book, in many ways, is a worthy successor to earlier studies of our region that have tended to be a little more ideologically driven, if I can put it that way. A number of the studies that may have come out of the work of prominent sociologists and economists. And I think one of the things that we've done here is try to see that diversity of a long project at work and to see the ways in which the region itself and its operation, both the economy and society and its politics, actually intersects with the physical environment. And so I'm actually looking back to an early set of notes that Claire and I put together as we tried to look at this discussion of the contribution and the significance in this region. And I'll read the title of the note. It says, quote, regionally informed or environmentally sympathetic, or was that regionally sympathetic and environmentally informed? And that's what we were trying to get at. How does this region itself, its environments, the distinctiveness of those environments, actually help us think about the way in which we have constructed region, mm-hmm. And therefore the historical processes that are at work in this region?
I mean, I'm sympathetic to Claire's Mackenzie King point of view. Atlantic Canada is representative of the entire country, but idiosyncratic in its own ways. Mm-hmm. Did any of you see geographic idiosyncrasies to the history of Atlantic Canada's environmental history? For example, the scale of the hinterland for the Atlantic Canadian provinces is considerably smaller than the Western Canadian provinces and even Ontario and Quebec. Do you see that playing a role in making the region distinct in terms of its environmental history?
Hmm.
I would think it's one of the reasons it's fallen under the radar to this point, for one, because again, so much of the Canadian language about environment is grand and grandiose and scale driven, and the kind of detail of you know, muscle med digging on a PEI shoreline that has, I think, historically been lost a little. So I think in some ways the scale has worked against it, just like the scale has worked against it, arguably in terms of the balance of power in Confederation since the 19th century. I don't know what other people would think about that.
Yeah, Sean, I guess my response would be a little bit off the, maybe it's off the mark, but you know, we've thought about Atlantic Canada in different comparisons, I think, than with you know, traditionally with Canada as a whole. And you know, we traditionally have very strong ties here, especially in New Brunswick. I don't think exclusively in New Brunswick, with New England as well. So, you know, we've conceptualized it from the beginning of Acadiensis, which I edited for a number of years, too many, you know, as the Atlantic region. So Acadiensis is the history of the Atlantic region, not the history of Atlantic Canada. And if you, and I was going and looking at Phil Buckner's here, the founding editor's mission statement in 1971, And it clearly said that the Atlantic region included Saint-Pierre-Miquelon, the Gaspésie, and a large part of Maine. So we tend to make comparisons, you know, on that basis as well, not simply with the larger Canadian narrative. And I wouldn't want to be the person to try to integrate Atlantic Canada into the larger Canadian narrative of environmental history. I think that there are some uniquenesses to it. I think there are also similarities within the region as well. So
if I could just jump in on that point, I spent the winter semester at McGill in their McGill Institute for Canadian Studies, and I mean, I was coming at it from the east, and I was seeing McGill, the St. Lawrence, as part of a Gulf of the St. Lawrence project. And so much of the language in Canadian studies and in the Canadian project is basically McGill is Montreal westward, right? It's turned away from the Atlantic. Yeah. So you don't conceive of basically eastern Quebec and anything east of Lake Ontario as part of what is in fact the eastern shoreline. And I think that's if you stand in central Canada and you look east, the Canadian project starts to look very different.
And I think another element of that are the highly regionalized economies that we have. I think if we look at the environmental history trajectories, if you like, what strikes me is the tremendous diversity, but the ways in which those are regionalized. So if we look at the significance of timber and fisheries, for example, and mineral resources to New Brunswick, if we look at the significance of fishery and agriculture and a deforested landscapes to Prince Edward Island, and obviously the significance of a coastal fishery, which in and of itself has its own quite micro geographies, right down to very, very small coastal communities, which are themselves quite fragmented. And so that's one of the big challenges here. And it's one of the debates I think we've had in this discussion is, are we talking about environmental history of Atlantic Canada, environmental history in Atlantic Canada is what we settled on for the book, but we also talked about environmental histories of Atlantic Canada with a real emphasis on the specifics and the regionality of that, and then the challenge of contextualizing that and part of, as Claire has put it, part of that bigger project at work. So the diversity in the region, I think, is one of the strengths that feeds in, and I think we hope shows up in the essays in the book.
Well, not to drill too finely into the idea of region, but maybe I can ask the group to speak a little bit about how cohesive the region of Atlantic Canada is. Did you find much interconnection between the four provinces, formerly colonies?
I would say that for most of the human history of the region of the four colonies, not the four colonies, but most of the history, that's the period before European contact, there are significant similarities in the sense that all all of the region has a pretty low carrying capacity in terms of human habitation.
Mm-hmm.
There are significant similarities in terms of marine and terrestrial flora and fauna. Probably Newfoundland is the outlier in this pattern, in the sense that there were much fewer mammals and a narrower range of edible flora. But I think once you get to the point of European indigenous contact, then you start to see fragmentation. So, you know, except for Nova Scotia, each of the three colonies settled on one major, you know, on really over-dependence on one resource. And, of cause, in Newfoundland, it's the cod fishery. In New Brunswick, it's the timber and then lumber trade. And then in Prince Edward Island, it's agriculture. So, you know, and then Nova Scotia tends to be a mixture of the three. So, so you start to see more fragmentation during the European period, but that's a fairly narrow slice of the environmental history of the region.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But even that, Bill, I mean, I think Bill's bang on in terms of his characterization, but even that's a commonality, in that each provincial economy becomes increasingly singular and increasingly dependent on an export resource.
Yeah, it's characteristic of resource frontiers, which is part of the colonial project.
Or indeed a differential set of jurisdictional contexts in terms of legislation around environmental management. And I think there are two essays in the book that really highlight that, in terms of Mark's work and Bill's work, in terms of the way in which there are particular approaches taken by provincial governments to environment and environmental management, differences start to appear, I think, as we compare those different, as I say, jurisdictional setups, and then look at the way in which settlement changes, the way in which industry clusters, necessarily around specific resources. And we start to see what Bill's referred to as fragmentation, but an increasing diversity in terms of what the consequences are for environmental histories and indeed contemporary environmental management.
I would also just add, I think it's like a lot of things that when you're outside the region looks much more cohesive. And the closer you get to the shoreline or to the ground, the more divergent and fragmented it looks. One of the other sort of niche initiatives has been supporting the new Northeast Atlantic Canada Environmental History Forum. And when you have Atlantic Canadian historians and historians of the American Northeast, there are some pretty profound jurisdictional differences, but there are also some really remarkable cross-border parallels in terms of, as Bill said, carrying capacity, in terms of different industrial foci.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not, I mean, it's, if you're in it, it's almost harder to see how those patterns, if you're deep in it, it's harder to see how those patterns in fact spill out from the region and are cohesive as they are.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I like the way Bill put it too, in terms of the longer history, in terms of patterns of human relations with natural resources in the region, of a pre-European world in which there's actually close similarity between the different areas of Atlantic Canada in terms of subsistence patterns of survival for people, and then a kind of fracturing of the relationship with natural resources as these resources get incorporated into, I guess, global networks of commodity exchange. But by the 20th century, are the regions not... Did they not find themselves sort of reconverging in terms of patterns of subsistence and survival, as the communities of New Brunswick and PEI and Nova Scotia and Newfoundland all become part of a much broader global network of consumer capitalism that greatly homogenizes the relationship with animals and plants as food?
You know what? I'm almost inclined to think that the homogenization that takes place is, I don't want to say sentimental, but it's more, and again, it's almost something that I would see as being more imposed on the region from the outside. The cohesion that the quote unquote maritimes emerge with is, again, its role relative to or vis-a-vis TROC. And the sense of commonality, I don't think is so much in that kind of material sense, Sean, that you mm-hmm. talk about, but one that is the region is cast as, you know, kind of more sensible or to a kind of strangely non-industrial lifestyle of family and tradition and culture and those kinds of things, that kind of romanticized image of the region. Mm-hmm. And I think in that sense, they're sort of blurred together. But in terms of the in terms of sort of active cooperation between mm-hmm. between provinces, of active initiatives between a lot of these scattered and depopulated communities, I think that's the kind of thing that environmentalists would like to see more than we've actually seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I guess it was the point I was driving at too, is that, you know, by the end of the 20th century, the suburbs of St. John are not terribly different from the suburbs of Halifax in terms of patterns of energy consumption. People are driving cars. People are eating fast food. The relationships with nature across all of North America seem broadly similar. It became, by the end of the 20th century, as wasteful consumers in St. John as there were in Vancouver or Victoria.
I think that's fair, but I do think, as someone who was a come from away for a lot of years, mm-hmm. There was always a sense of, if you left Halifax with its multiple universities and plenty of people who were from away, you didn't go very far outside the city to scratch a long-standing memory of earlier relationships with nature and earlier types of community. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to perpetuate, again, this kind of traditionalist image of the Maritimes, but I do think that one thing that has kept the Maritimes distinct in some ways from, you know, say, suburbs of Okotoks, is is a depth of memory that persists. And I think for a historian, that's really valuable.
I think if I can just chime in there, I mean, I think Claire made this point in the introduction to the book as well, by focusing on the, you know, the small settlement of Denmark, Nova Scotia, in terms of the memory that's actually built into the landscape. I want to add to that, though, that there's also a pretty active process for constructing the present environment. And we see it in the ways in which the Nova Scotia government quite explicitly developed a set of processes for tourism, obviously as well in Prince Edward Island, or latterly in New Brunswick. So I think the modernity that gets constructed in the late 20th century mm-hmm. is really done quite actively, and there are elements of convergence around that, absolutely. And I think you're correct to point to suburban development, elements of urban development, consumer processes.
Even some of the experiences with deindustrialization that are covered in the book, yeah.
Yeah, and then the other thing that I think we also need to contextualize here is the elements of divergence that are apparent. So you know, who would have thought that the Newfoundland and Labrador economy would essentially and very quickly become such an energy-based economy, such that it is now a contributing economy economically to transfer payments in this country. And so there's a divergence that's emerged very quickly, and we're seeing those changes rapidly in the Newfoundland Labrador economy. We're seeing elements of that in the economies of New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and to some extent PEI as well, as they tap into using migration as a resource and using that to bring resources in from other parts of the country, notably Fort McMurray. So there are elements here, I think, that may even be pointing to greater divergence emerging at the present time. And that, I think, has challenges for us as managers and contributors to policy development.
Well, maybe we can drill down now into one of the specific case studies. Bill, your particular essay in the anthology deals with forestry and progressive forest conservation in New Brunswick in the early 20th century. And could you tell us a little bit about how the emergence of progressive era conservation played out in the forestry sector in New Brunswick in the early decades of the 20th century?
Yeah. I think it's a pretty standard story of progressive forest conservation, in the sense that, you know, really just fit into the broader movement that was sweeping across North America starting about 1890 and coming to a head around the end of the First World War. when New Brunswick passed its first Forest Fire Act. So if you look at things like, you know, there's resource depletion in New Brunswick as there is in the northeast the part of North America. There's the opening of a forestry school, the realization that the forest resources of the province are finite and can be destroyed, but they're also renewable. So all those things happen. And then the sort of, climax of that is the first modern Forest Fire and Forest Fires Act. I mean, the thing that I found and why I wrote this particular piece for the book was that, you know, nobody had really written on the subject in Atlantic Canada, even though, you know, from a larger North American perspective, it's one of the earliest and most prominent topics in the field of North American environmental history.
Mm-hmm.
So first off, I really wanted to write something that situated the New Brunswick experience and the regional experience within that larger context.
Mm-hmm.
But I also wanted something that was teachable. I wanted something that I was accessible to an upper level undergraduate course that I could teach in conjunction with discussions of the Progressive Era, because the Forest Conservation Crusade was probably in Canada the most prominent of the progressive issues in terms of natural resources. So that was the first objective. But secondly, I wanted to emphasize a few aspects of the New Brunswick experience that I think contributes to this literature, which is large and of long duration, as I said. Well, mm-hmm. The first one is that I wanted to make very clear the point that forestry as a discipline, much like other engineering disciplines, was intimately tied to the development of modern corporations. So, there's this massive consolidation movement around the turn of the century, and that's just when foresters are starting to try to assert themselves as a forestry as a discipline and foresters as a profession. And so it's not coincidental. And forestry as a science, as a discipline, really struggles for professional legitimacy in at least the first two decades of its creation in the form of forestry school.
Mm-hmm.
So they really need allies within this new emerging kind of corporate model of forest management to advance the profession and to create jobs within bureaucracies and within private industry.
Mm-hmm.
What industry gets from this is they get a sort of technical scientific legitimation changing forest policy in various places to be more amenable with this large, capitalized, vertically integrated corporate model of forest resource exploitation, which involves the much larger concentration of resources in fewer hands,
mm-hmm.
And changes to various state processes. So that's the first part. The second part was that I wanted to show how for heavily forest-dependent communities, this linking of arms between the emerging forestry profession and this new corporate model had the potential, in fact, in New Brunswick did alter the form and function of the provincial state. So mm-hmm. what we see in New Brunswick, and I expect elsewhere, is with the new Forest Acts and Forest Fire Act that comes in 1918, you see the old Crown Land Department rebranded as the Department of Lands and Mines. In the following two decades, the institution does several things. One thing is it institutes civil service reform, which takes politics out of the administration of the forest. Well, one of the problems in New Brunswick from a modern corporate perspective is that access to the forest and benefits from forest exploitation were distributed through the party system. So if you were, for example, a conservative lumberman,
mm-hmm.
Affiliated with the Conservative Party, you did very well when the Conservatives were in power. And then, you might not do so well when the Liberals are in power. So they wanted to take it out of the legislature. They wanted to take that internal control of the forest policy within the state political apparatus and institute civil service reform and create long-term legal contracts to make sure that, in a sense, they're always in power, regardless of what party's in power. So that's what I wanted to show. And the last part I wanted to show is that, after the new Forest and Forest Fires Act, the Department of Lands and Mines, the forest bureaucracy, started to make the conversion from being, revenue generating apparatus for the state to a service agency for industry. So in the period from 1918 to 1922, fully 40% of provincial revenues came from Crown land fees paid by forest entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
By 1939, that was down to the low teens.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it has to do with state sponsorship of forest fire protection, which is for the benefit essentially, which is controversial, believe it or not, but it's also for the benefit of fewer and fewer Crown land leaseholders.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even in that earlier period, that's quite extraordinary percentage of the provincial budget coming from the forestry sector.
It is. I mean, there is an over dependence on forest production in New Brunswick. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the 1920s changes things significantly because you have the gasoline tax coming in, and of course you have the temporary income tax coming in, mm-hmm. Which proved to be not so temporary. But I think that this sort of framework, I think, can be applied to varying degrees to other jurisdictions, particularly in the American Southeast after the after 1900 and on the west coast of Canada and the United States. So that's a point that I wanted to make that I think contributes to the literature. It's maybe not exactly new, but it's a renewed kind of and more intensified emphasis on these sort of structural materialist issues.
Mm-hmm. And you make a strong case about a kind of interconnecting or melding of the interests between the emerging provincial state and these private corporations. Do you see lessons or this case study as being sort of representative of what was happening across Canada in terms of resource industries and provincial governments?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the linking arms, certainly. Yeah, I mean, if you read Mark Kullberg's book on the 100th anniversary of the Toronto Forestry School, mm-hmm. and you can see how seamlessly people move into industry, government, and universities,
mm-hmm.
In terms of being professional foresters. So I think that has very long term implications for a place like New Brunswick.
And if I can finally push you into talking about fracking, Bill, do you see lessons for New Brunswick in terms of its current resource industry interests?
Yeah, I don't think you need to push very hard. I think what happens, this is the genesis of what I think there's linking arms and this sort of marriage between forestry and corporations in the state, which isn't uncomplicated. In any way, and it's not a conspiracy, but this sort of linking of arms really creates a consensus among these three groups, and results in what social scientists have called the techno-corporate state. This iron triangle of government, industry, and scientific forestry on various issues. So as the federal government gets more involved in forestry, forest science emerges in the middle decades of the 20th century, and corporations become entrenched in a major driving force in that structure. Then you really see how difficult it is when the environmental movement starts to gather steam, mm-hmm. in the 1960s. How difficult it is for citizens groups to penetrate that iron triangle. Mm-hmm. So the best case study would be Mark. I think that's part of what Mark's getting at in his essay on budworm spraying that's in the book.
Mm-hmm.
But also I think it's characteristic of the very public debate in the 1970s by citizens groups in the Conservation Council of New Brunswick, which that's its really first major campaign. It just shows how difficult it is, because what happens in New Brunswick as opposed to Nova Scotia is the burden of proof is on the citizens group to show tangibly that, budworm spraying is harmful to human health, which is a difficult thing to do, that kind of causality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Nova Scotia, they'd rejected the chemical solution for 30 years. And when they tried to introduce it in the 70s, and this was Elizabeth May's first major campaign, the burden of proof was on the companies and the state to show that it wasn't harmful to human health. And they'd seen what had gone on in New Brunswick. So So I think that's a lesson for New Brunswick, and I think it's also a lesson for us in terms of the whole fracking debate. The government keeps saying to us that they're going to have the strictest fracking regulations in North America. Well, I'm sorry, I studied natural resources in New Brunswick from the beginning, and there's never been a case once where New Brunswick had the strongest, natural resource regulations in terms of the environment, in any industry. And I don't expect that to happen now. And in fact, there's also a significant divergence between the actual regulations that are passed and the enforcement of those regulations. So, the pulp and paper industry has been allowed to pollute the air and the water for 60 years. And occasionally there's a nominal fine paid when the mess gets too big or in various cycles of public agitation. So I would say fracking is a situation where it's difficult to believe that New Brunswick of all places is the jurisdiction where we're going to have sensible and effective regulations around fracking.
And we had Mark McLaughlin on the podcast last year when we talked about the environmental movement. And he told us a little bit about his case study on insecticide spraying and budworm in New Brunswick, which in a lot of ways seemed to me to be a significant turning point in this kind of coalition of environmental interests between the provincial state, science, and private industry, as well as citizens in New Brunswick, who for much of this history through the 19th and 20th century seemed at least to see their own self-interest being served in that relationship between science, industry, and the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if you looked at all of North America, then you'd see, the interim between the progressive conservation movement and the environmental movement, you'd see that kind of developmentalist ideology being evident in most places. Mm-hmm. But at that time, the field of ecology is starting to develop hydrology and people are, and scientists are really the ones who are looking for technical solutions to water, air, and other forms of pollution. So I don't think New Brunswick's particularly unique in that sense.
So this was just one of several excellent case studies in this anthology. Before we run out of time, I want to ask the group what they see as the future of environmental history of the Atlantic Canadian region. If you could think of a kind of wish list of where you hope researchers go, what might come to mind?
I'll go first, I guess. I think the earlier period. I've done a project called Loyalist Environments where we looked at river fisheries legislation, which comes really 2 years after New Brunswick's formed, and it actually starts in the 1760s in Nova Scotia. So there's a fascinating environmental history of the Loyalist and pre-Loyalist period to be written during the European era. So I think there's that, and that's the weakest part of our historiography right now. But my response really to that is more not so much subject areas, but emphasis. I think we're really in a transitional period in most places in Atlantic Canada right now, and I think it's really incumbent upon environmental historians to take part in the public discourse on a lot of these issues and to have their voices heard, because I think we have a lot to offer. We have a long, long history of resource exploitation here. And as with fracking, there are a lot of these issues where an historical perspective can really contribute to the political discourse and really address some of the misconceptions that are being put out there by corporations and our government. And I think that in New Brunswick, in particular, we have a freedom of speech problem here, and people at the university, like myself, I think have really a responsibility, because we are protected, certainly by our unions, and one would hope by our universities to speak our mind and to have the freedom to do that.
Hear, hear. I think that's brilliant. And I absolutely agree. Yeah, Sean, I'd say that in terms of where the field needs to go, it's not necessarily a wish list of subjects or topics so much as it is continuing the trajectory of mobilization and engagement in terms of history, not simply for scholarship's sake. People in Atlantic Canada are living through the consequences of centuries of environmental degradation. And, you know, we can teach about it. That's one kind of engagement. But being as honest and as frank as we can about the costs of those things, especially when we see, because we see it in Nova Scotia as well, governments committing, again, in Mackenzie King-like, both to green initiatives and to unprecedented offshore, for example, or other kind of resource projects, or sustaining, you know, unsustainable pulp mills, that kind of thing. So the having even come to the end of the line on some major resource-based industries, like, you know, the classic example of the coal closing in Cape Breton, has only partly dislodged the trajectory of the region and the mindset that the next big thing is just over the hill or just off the Scotian shelf. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think historians are really, it is as Bill was suggesting, it's a civic duty to be as honest and as frank and as relentless about that message as we can be.
Let me add as well that I think there are a number of sort of topical elements that also feed into the approach that we take to environmental history and its relevance. I'm thinking particularly, and it does come back to the example that Bill has used in terms of the fracking debate right across Atlantic Canada at the present time. Much of what we've framed in terms of how we use our resources comes out of that developmental perspective, long histories of particular forms of settler capitalism. And there's a piece for First Nations that I think is assuming a much greater, not just political importance, although we certainly see that in many parts of the country at the present time, but also are helping us to reconceive of the nature of environment and how we frame it. And that has to then feed into the sorts of discussions that we have as academics, our role in contributing to policy development, and the way in which we can broaden that whole discussion about what the environment is. And as we get a better handle on that, we're in a much stronger position to contribute to policy development. So one of the things that I think we've all been engaged in a variety of our discussions is how do we take the examples that we have here in our own research and find outlets for those in such a way that we can be seen to be influencing the way in which forest policy operates or mining policy or even the ways in which several, you know, green initiatives for urban communities operate. And we do have the advantage as environmental historians of this long approach and a long sense of the broader processes that have been at work in our region and the context for those more broadly. And so there, as I think was clear, used the word responsibility a few minutes ago. And I think that responsibility comes from much of this, what I would see as a geographer, that sort of accretion in the landscape of environmental change that we carry forward.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot more to be said about the environmental history of Atlantic Canada, but listeners should first pick up a copy of Land and Sea, Environmental History in Atlantic Canada. I want to thank you, Robert, Bill, and Claire, for sharing some of your thoughts on this fascinating new anthology and some of the broader thoughts on the environmental history of this region of Canada.
John, if I could just continue that plug just a little bit. The book can be ordered from the Acadiensis, which is easily accessible on the internet. So.
Absolutely, and we'll be linking to that site on our show notes for this episode. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Thanks, Sean.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Claire Campbell, Robert Summerby Murray, Bill Parenteau, and me, Sean Courage. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes page at niche-canada.org/naturespast, where you can download new episodes, subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, and leave us comments. Please let us know what you think about the podcast, and don't forget to rate and review this podcast on our iTunes page. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/naturespast. You can always get the latest information on events in the environmental history community from the NICHE website at niche-canada.org. And you can find out more about the topics we discussed on this episode on our show notes page. To keep up with current work in the field of environmental history, I encourage listeners to download our iOS app, which works on iPhone, iPod Touch, and the iPad. You can get the app at niche-canada.org/envhist. That's ENVHIST. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon with another episode of Nature's Past.